Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us. We're here in the Football Scholars Forum session of October of 2013, and we're discussing Africa's World Cup, critical reflections on play, patriotism, spectatorship, and space, an edited volume by Peter Leggi and Chris Boltzmann. Peter, would you like to say a few things about the book before we kick off our discussion?
Yeah, Chris and I spoke just a few minutes ago, so we're both going to say a few things, but we're going to keep our comments brief so that we can have a wide-ranging discussion with everyone online. Thanks so much for joining the conversation. Look forward to the dialogue. The inspiration for the book maybe would be good to open with, because it's a bit of a strange book in some respects. Chris and I had done an edited volume before the World Cup. There was a special issue of the journal Soccer and Society. It had about half the number of contributors that Africa's World Cup had, so it was a little bit easier to manage in some respects, but it was clearly an academic project from the beginning. You know, we had to go through peer review, and it was published in a journal, and then also as an edited volume by Routledge, which, you know, it's the same company as Taylor & Francis that publishes the journal Soccer and Society. And we learned a lot, I think, Chris and I, from that experience. One of the things that I learned was that, you know, perhaps putting all of this knowledge and insight behind a journal paywall wasn't the best way to write and think about it and discuss the issues related to the World Cup in South Africa in 2010. Okay, then Chris and I got together during the World Cup in South Africa, and we started brainstorming, you know, how to get around this issue of writing primarily for an academic audience in academic outlets. And, you know, we had a podcast interview in July of 2010 where we started to publicly discuss the pros and cons of the World Cup. And we started contacting people, first informally, and then after the University of Michigan Press contacted us to see if we were interested in publishing this book with them, we also started contacting people formally. And the rules of the game were to write really from the heart as much as from the head, and to feel free to write about things that, you know, to write in the first person, for instance, to write about perhaps whimsical things as much as quote-unquote serious things. And we also asked some people who maybe had not had a lot of exposure writing about football. And so, you know, we have an architect in there, we have a museum curator, we have several coaches, also some journalists who obviously write to a broad audience on a regular basis, but maybe don't reach academics. And then we started collecting the pieces together. And by early 2011, we had a serviceable manuscript that we sent off to the anonymous reviewers at the University of Michigan Press. And that was an interesting process because they wanted a more scholarly manuscript than we had initially put forward to them. So the revisions took about 6 to 9 months. And I think in the end, even though we were a little bit frustrated by the delays, we were happy with the compromises and the outcome overall. And I have to say that working with a university press like Michigan Press was really satisfying. They put all the photographs we wanted in the book, which was really important to give a visual record, at least a limited one, for the readers. And also they did agree to do a paperback version right off the bat. And that had not happened in our previous experience with Routledge / Taylor & Francis. The book was being sold for $120. I'm referring to South Africa and the global game, Football Apartheid and Beyond. So if you want to alienate readers and make sure nobody reads it, that's a great way to go about it. And Michigan Press, thankfully, issued both a hardcover and a paperback straight off the bat, and we negotiated for that. So we were quite pleased with the outcome. Chris, any thoughts from your end?
Yeah, hello everybody from London. I think one of the legacies of the World Cup, and I imagine the majority of us here are academics, is the The number of journal articles and special editions of journals that have been published over the last 3 or 4 years, specifically focusing on the World Cup. And my sense was that you were getting people writing on security issues, tourism-related issues, service delivery-related issues, and nothing really on the football itself. And I think Pete and I have both been keen footballers, middle-aged footballers, but also writing on football. We wanted to write something where we could actually talk about experiences as football fans watching the World Cup, and me being a South African watching my first World Cup in my own country was indeed a wonderful experience. And that's, I think, what we try to get across, and hopefully many of you have experienced it in that manner.
Yeah, and just one more thing before we open it up. You know, this really is a collaborative project, and we saw it as such right from the beginning. And I think especially historians, but also many other scholars in the social sciences and humanities, tend to work individually. And I found it extremely fulfilling and satisfying to work with so many good people who were really quite accommodating through the process of editing, through the slight delays in production and so on. It was, it really, I thought, was one of the best parts of the experience for me.
Fantastic. I just wanted to say very quickly before we jump into comments as well that it was very special diving back into the material of the book, because I arrived maybe 2 weeks for the first time in Argentina before the World Cup in 2010, and it was great, especially the chapters that focus on following the teams themselves and identity and performance, just remembering the results of the game and of the games and the tournament itself, and especially Laurent's piece at the end, just giving this very clear sense of the stage of dreams. It was fantastic, very enjoyable getting back into the material and thinking about this after 3 years now, and now we're quite close to Brazil's World Cup. So the purpose, if there was a deliberate effort at being playful in this book, I think was achieved in flying colors, and I very very much enjoyed many of the chapters I read. So compliments to everyone who was involved in the book, whom we have many on this call, and to Peter and Chris for making it all happen. So let's get started with some questions, and we'll start with a group of folks who are calling from Durham, shepherded by Laurent.
Hey, can you hear me okay?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, great. Yeah, I'm here with Ishiel Bembe and student Jordan Pearson from my soccer politics class. And since Ishiel and I sort of spent the World Cup together, and the piece I wrote it was sort of in many ways indebted to our conversations, it's nice to have him here. I guess, you know, one thing that interests me about the book is the way in which this is a real reflection of the way that soccer writing, the kind of broad soccer writing or the kind of experimentation that a lot of academics who are writing on soccer have started to do by writing in more digital formats, gets kind of brought back into the book format here, which I thought was really useful. In other words, I think a lot of us were starting to write in not in academic journals, but in other ways about the World Cup. And then it was great to see, you know, to sort of pull that kind of writing. And I think, you know, a certain number of these pieces were on blogs originally in some form. Pull that writing into a book format so that it doesn't just sort of, because in digital space is at once very open, but things can be very short-lived there and can kind of disappear as well. So I don't know if, you know, I was curious if that became an issue as you were sort of editing with the press or the readers' reports, or whether this sort of sense of the openness that this book exemplifies in terms of writing about sport, you know, whether you had to kind of fight for that, or whether that kind of was accepted by the readers. That was just one thought I had, because I really like the diversity of just voice in this book as well. So.
Chris, do you want to begin
the
answer?
Look, I think from the outset we said to contributors, write, as Peter's already said, in the first person, tell us your experiences, what did it mean to you in whatever guise, wherever you may have been, whether you'd been in Europe or the Americas or in South Africa itself. It was a case of really just putting your thoughts down and your feelings and your experiences. And I think through the editing process with some of the comments that came in from the from the reviewers, we try to bring in references where appropriate. But I think in all we've original texts as they came in, because I think that was the joy of reading Mayavish text, because it took me right back into some of the stadia, it took me right back into some of the fan parks and into some of the cities that I visited in South Africa. So I think we left it as pretty much as close to the original text as we could.
Yeah, and one thing that I remember is that several of the contributors were writing in a language that was not their first language, and so the reviewers noted how maybe we could work a little bit in making the styles more consistent. Also, there were some that privileged a slightly more academic voice over a kind of journalistic voice, for lack of a better term, and we did a little bit of work there. Sometimes quite a bit of work, honestly, in trying to make the chapters more consistent in that way. And one other comment that I remember the reviewers making that did require some work on our part was that the architecture of the book was not originally in the first version of the manuscript, the one that eventually emerged. In the final version, you've got four parts that are thematically arranged. One is the urban spaces and local struggles in major host cities. Then you've got the one sort of on culture, music, aesthetics, and so on. Then the long one on spectatorship and nationalism and patriotism. And then finally, the more analytical pieces on politics and economics. That wasn't in the original plan. So I think we benefited from trying to make the organization a little tighter, clarifying what the anchoring themes in each part really were. And so I think there's a lesson there, and that is that, you know, maybe going through this rigorous academic peer reviewing did sharpen the structure of the book and maybe lent it a bit of focus that it lacked in the beginning. It sort of channeled those heartfelt sentiments and emotions a little more firmly and perhaps functionally. So I thought in the end that was helpful, but the disadvantage was that we lost quite a bit of time, you know, lost in quotation marks. I mean, the peer review process is lengthy and there was a lot of back and forth. And so we wanted to publish this book, you know, a year or so before it actually came out. But in the end, I think, you know, it benefited as a result. And you don't get that in the blog format. In the blog format, you know, you write it, you maybe sit on it for a few hours, maybe a day, and then you click publish, and then it's out for everybody to see. And there's an immediacy there that's fantastic. But I think there's also, particularly for an edited collection with so many pieces and perspectives, the outside comments, I thought, were an important part of the story and influenced how it eventually came out.
Peter and Chris, my name is Ashil.
Hello, Ashil.
Hi, and Sean too. I haven't read the book yet. I just had a quick look at it because Laurent gave me a copy. I will read it. Judging from the table of contents, it seems to me that it covers a huge amount of ground, and I really like the way in which you try to bring different voices to bear on a topic that is itself so so huge and somewhat and weighty. I just have two questions. One, to what extent is it that the reflections gathered here might help us to start reading what's going to happen in Brazil next year? In other words, is the South African experiment with the World Cup of any use in interpreting the global politics of soccer as manifested in what's going to happen in Brazil? The second is, it seems to me a bit difficult to see what it is that we have gained from organizing the World Cup in South Africa. Of course, we have inherited these infrastructure, which is the case in Johannesburg especially, but also in other cities, we have these big stadia, some of which are working, being used, others not that much. In fact,
we seem to have lost you.
Municipalities where they were built. Sorry.
Peter, can you still hear Hashim?
Yes, I'm still here.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm wondering what are your thoughts 3 years later in terms of what it is that we have gained from organizing the World Cup, and in terms of where it is that African soccer is going. I understand that these are broad questions, but it seems to me that these are precisely the kind of issues your book allows us to think.
Chris, do you want to take the first stab, or would you like me to respond
first? Yeah, no, I'd like to have a go at the second question, and that's the standard of, I'd say specifically South African football. When FIFA announced in May 2004 that we would host the World Cup in 2010, my first concern then was that South Africa would not have a team that would be competitive, and that's exactly the case. The first host nation to actually bow out of their own tournament after the first round. The fact that we haven't qualified for Brazil, Ethiopia topping our group, I think, is a reflection on the state of South African football. The fact that the Football Association, SAFA, has just lost its technical sponsor, and one of its largest sponsors, APSA, the banking group, is a great shame, because it suggests that that these sponsors are leaving an organisation, and indeed a football side, which is not particularly competitive. Looking at the rankings between 60 and 70, it's just not good enough. So, in terms of a legacy on the football field in South Africa, I'm afraid there isn't a positive one.
Yeah, I think in terms of the economics of the tournament, can you hear me? We seem to have lost you again.
We can hear you, Peter. Go ahead.
Okay. In terms of the economics of the tournament also, the legacy is clearly in the red. Even the chairperson of the local organizing committee of 2010, Mr. Danny Jordan, a former history lecturer, as well as anti-apartheid sport administrator, admitted and actually apologized for the enormous costs that South Africa incurred in. He did this just recently for hosting the tournament. So there's no question that South Africa lost money in hosting the tournament. And the symbol of this, of course, is the white elephants. Those glitzy, glamorous, high-tech, high-modernist stadiums that are, by and large, sitting empty week in and week out in South Africa's host cities, right? So I think that's the bridge to Brazil as well, because, as you know, the protests that have been taking place since the middle of last year that started as a protest against higher bus fares, basically use the 2014 World Cup as an example of the kind of maladministration and corruption and misdirection of public funds that Brazilians are terribly upset about. And, building a stadium in Brasilia, like the Garrincha Stadium, for over 70,000 people in a city where the local football club draws 1,000 a game, is clearly a poor decision and a predictably poor decision. The same in Manaus. In Manaus, there's a 45,000-seat stadium that's rising out of the Amazonian soil. And that's not a football city. As Dave Zirin said recently in an interview with Al Jazeera America, Manaus is not a football destination, it's a breathing destination. And so there's similarities here, there are lessons. And unfortunately, because of the way these mega events are run, they have their own internal logic and mechanisms. We see the same mistakes being made in Brazil that were made in South Africa in many respects. The waste of public funds for private gain. We're not going to see this in the same way in Qatar in 2022 or in Russia in 2018, because those are two autocratic societies where you're not going to get the kind of public dissent and critique that you got in South Africa and that you're getting today in Brazil. But for the global South, you know, there are emotional legacies that are largely positive. You know, the ideological success of hosting this tournament, I think many of the contributors in the volume point to, you know, and that's one of the central contradictions that, you know, this 2010 World Cup was a tremendous success. The same could be said, will probably be said of 2014, especially if Brazil ends up on top. You can imagine the party that is going to take place in the streets of Brazil if the Seleção wins its sixth world title. You know, maybe people will feel united and in solidarity with each other, you know, in ways that they don't generally. Maybe Brazil, like South Africa, will be seen as a modern, democratic, business-friendly tourist destination. Maybe some of the negative stereotypes about Brazilians, as was the case with South Africa, would be challenged. So there are some potential positives in there as well that we can get from the comparison. But I'm worried about the economic aspect of the story, because the lessons from South Africa are quite brutal. And I think FIFA really is not playing a fair game. They are constructing these agreements in a way that clearly, you know, put the host nations in a difficult situation. And again, I think this is why we're going to Russia in 2018 and why we're going to Qatar in 2022. In these the petrodollars in these autocratic societies are why we're going to go there. And FIFA is happy to have a situation where you're not going to get resistance and critique of these kinds of arrangements. But those are very, very problematic.
Fantastic. And I'd just like to note here, as we're moving through our participants, Laurent Dubois' chapter in the edited volume was in the theater of the World Cup. And I'd like to ask Andrew Guest, who was the author of the chapter Screaming USA and Other Imagined Things, Us Versus Them, South Africa 2010. If you have any questions or comments for your fellow contributors and the participants.
Sure, I'll try to ask a couple questions. I definitely appreciate being included in the book and really like the book. And I guess I might try to build off the last question a little bit, because as I've sort of reviewed it for today, I have been curious about the how it's been received along the lines of what's already been said, which is that it does strike me as a little bit betwixt and between. Like it's somewhat academic, but it's also somewhat popular and journalistic. And I really like that. I mean, I think there should be more writing like that. But I worry that it risks sort of being betwixt and between. So I guess I'd just be curious from the editors to hear a little bit about the reception, or you know, how it's been kind of taken up in the little time that it's been out. And that's sort of part one. And then part two, I guess, to build more on the last question, would be not just about what, you know, how South Africa's World Cup informs the next World Cup, but in terms of writing and in terms of projects, doing this project, I'd be curious what either the editors or actually any of the folks on the call think they would really like to see in regards to writing about Brazil, and what feels like important types of, you know, to borrow from the subtitle, critical reflections that are going to need to be offered, or what types of, you know, projects that again might borrow from scholarly perspectives but target the more general audience that is so massive for a World Cup. Would people be feel like are particularly important or are hopeful to see? And I'll mute myself with that.
I think it's too early to tell how the book's been received. I mean, this is really a great meeting to start talking about that. I'm curious to hear your opinions of the book, what worked and what didn't, and so on and so forth. I haven't read any reviews in any journals. Again, the book only came out late May of 2013. So And I'll turn it over to Chris and the rest of the group maybe about that second question.
Alex, maybe we can hear some other voices.
Sure, everyone can chime in as they'd like. I'd like to jump in on this. I'm really glad this book exists in that vein, and that there was a clear tone that you all wanted to strike when you decided to go after publishing the book and who was going to make it in and what kind of pieces you're going after. And I wonder how creative or fantastical you got in entertaining other options other than an edited volume. Was that ever part of the conversation? Was there any interest from U of M in making this part of their increasing digital offers in terms of what the press has put its stamp on? And maybe something for 2014. I mean, can you imagine doing the same thing, even with many of these same authors, but in an online published piece that sort of evolved over the year? Something that would be fascinating for, I think, both scholars and people interested to see is how that conversation played out over the last year with you and the publisher saying, well, what exactly did it look like before it was not academic enough for the publisher, and what sort of strategies did the authors adopt to modify their pieces, and is that something that could be reproduced in a forum format or something like some digital books have gone after, and having an open peer review process where you see the material evolving before your eyes.
We did talk about digital outlets with Michigan Press. In fact, they have a very interesting part of the press that has been putting out digital first books using Comment Press and other platforms. So we did talk about that, but they decided they wanted to go the analog way. Mm-hmm. And you know, frankly, at where we were, we were comfortable with that. But I think in the future, it would be nice if a book like this could be taken fully digital from the very beginning and maybe receive input from the public during the editing process, the same way that some of these books that the Michigan Press digital arm is doing. You know, you can incorporate audiovisual materials very nicely. A lot of the people who were in South Africa who contributed to this book have photographs. I mean, Chris Boltzmann has a treasure trove of wonderful photographs that he took, like the one on the cover of the book. I know Davey Lane had wonderful video that he took all across the country following Uruguay. In a digital platform, we could embed that into the product, if you will. And I think that would be quite rich, and I hope somebody does that for 2014 in Brazil. I think it might have been a little too early for us to attempt it this time around, but I think it's an exciting possibility, and, you know, the sky's the limit.
Laurent, did you want to jump in on this current line?
Yes, just really quickly, because Sheila and I were getting excited about this idea. I think that, you know, Sheila was just saying that the idea of a kind of open book for this kind of writing would be nice, you know, if there's a way to incorporate what's here, but then a kind of opening for more things about Brazil. I'm having my students develop a guide, an online guide on soccer politics for the 2014 World Cup, and they have a lot of great ideas. I mean, I think that the possibilities, and unfortunately university presses are not as, I think, head in this regard, in the way a configuration in which the book would be very important, because I think it's great to have a book and for people to be able to buy a book, whether in electronic or paper format. But to make that a piece of a larger web of things could certainly be something that could be conceived nicely. So, I mean, I think that the book in some ways just invites us to think about how it could be at the center of, you know, a set of ongoing discussions. And I think it's, you know, the digital space, there's a place between where a kind of more curated digital space, maybe a more carefully presented and developed one. I would say that the Roads and Kingdoms Sports Illustrated collaboration, which they're doing heading up to the World Cup, is sort of tapping into that and getting people to write essays for a bigger publication, but out of academic work. So anyway, it's just to throw that out. It'd be interesting to think about that even in this particular group, about how that might be done. I do think there's so much energy and interest in this kind of writing about soccer. And so it's, you know, a base, I mean, partly it's just to say bravo for doing the book, but also it's an invitation to do more of the same in different formats.
I'm glad you mentioned this group, because my next comment was going to be, if only we had some kind of online medium through which academics that study soccer could discuss this sort of idea, maybe execute a plan. But we'll see if
I think Ashila is typing in something, he's writing in an open book curated before, during, and after the World Cup with text, images, sound material. I mean, and the other interesting thing would be the idea of inviting, right? I mean, it could be centered around academic work and this kind of core participants, but obviously invite the kinds of ways that things like, you know, like that Pinterest or Tumblr or those sorts of things invite the giving of pictures, right? Because people, I think a lot of people would offer photographs. You'd need to curate it, obviously, you know, you wouldn't want it to be overwhelming, but anyway, it's just an idea.
Sure, and as Peter said, I think the sky's the limit, and there will probably be many folks who listen to this recording and have a keen interest on participating in something that that fits along those lines. Derek, do you have a question that's piggybacking on this that you want to fit in?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Sure.
One of the things I've noticed is that I can't help but wonder if the 2010 World Cup is the most written about World Cup in terms of that intersection between academics, journalists, and sort of more popular, you know, football as football. And I'm curious if that is the impression that others have, but also sort of along those lines, it seems like we're starting a run of such World Cups. I would imagine Brazil will have similar dynamics, and certainly, you know, Qatar and Russia will have comparable. I wonder if that's just sort of happenstance, or if we have this perfect storm right now of increased scholarly attention, increased sort of emphasis on sport and politics, and so forth, and if maybe Africa's World Cup, if we want to call it that, kind of kicked that off.
Sure. Great question. Peter and Chris?
Alex, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it goes back to the comment I made earlier. I mean, when Peter and I originally started the first edited collection, our concern was that we weren't going to have enough, or we weren't going to have anything on the World Cup in South Africa, and we were pleasantly surprised, and indeed we were wrong, because we have so much that's come out. But I think what it possibly points towards is studying sport being a legitimate academic endeavor. I think the US is far, far further down the road than what we are in the United Kingdom, and indeed in South Africa. But I think it is a wonderful opportunity to take it forward, to look at Brazil, to look at Russia and Qatar, but indeed to go back and look at South Africa, and indeed as more files, for example, at FIFA are going to be released and are being released as we speak relating to the World Cup, we'll be able to look at it in a different way, in a different light in the future.
Peter, anything to add before we move on to another question?
No, but I want to draw Liz Timms here in East Lansing into the conversation, because I was thinking of reception. I did use the book in a summer online course with about 100 or so students, and maybe Liz has some thoughts about how they received it. They were blogging about it extensively and wrote about it in more conventional ways too. Liz?
Hi, everyone. Yeah, the great thing about this book is that we brought it in at the end of the 8 weeks of the course, I guess week seven, we brought it in. And so we'd really gone through the history of the game. And by the time we got to the selections from Africa's World Cup, the students really had a lot to build on. And they drew out a lot when we read the selections. We read the roundtable and the article on Waka Waka, right? Mm-hmm. And so they really connected what they were reading to bigger issues like colonialism and globalization. And the things that they really responded to were the pieces that established a personal connection. And I think when we're talking about the 2014 World Cup in Brazil, that's the kind of thing that's going to be really useful, especially for students, for course adoption, or things that's going to make them feel like they were there. It gives them something to connect to, because that's really what the students in the culture of soccer class connected to. And it made them feel like they were a part of the conversation.
fantastic. Christoph, did you have a question?
Yes, I do have a comment on the book in general, since I had the pleasure to review the book, and I must say I really enjoyed reading the book, all of it. But I do have a question regarding the selection process for the pieces in there. What were you looking for? Were you mainly looking for people from outside Africa, or what was your idea in gathering that material, which is very, very good to read, actually, I must say. So what was your plan behind the selection?
Chris?
Look, I think it was a case of trying to identify people who were in South Africa initially, possibly South Africans who experienced the World Cup. But I think one of the contradictions of the first African World Cup in South Africa was that a number of traditional South African football fans were excluded from the stadiums, and issues of exclusion, I think, are crucial in understanding the South African World Cup. So I was trying to identify people who were possibly in the country, who were possibly South African, but then, of course, expand that to people who were visiting the country, and indeed people who watched the World Cup from afar, because I think if we look at John's chapter on watching the World Cup from a Parisian bar, I think adds a whole new dynamic to understanding an African World Cup from a Parisian viewpoint. So I think it was a case of trying to identify a range of different voices inside academia and indeed outside.
Yeah, and also, you know, we did canvas many more people than what you see in the final version of the book. And as always happens with edited collections, you know, many agreed to participate, but others did not. And, you know, that's just the nature of any kind of collaborative project of this kind. So, you know, and also, I think despite what Derek Katzam was saying earlier about the 2010 World Cup having been covered quite extensively compared to previous ones in academia and in a serious way by non-academics too, in South Africa, you know, there's been very little actually that's been published. And in fact, a South African publisher turned down our idea for this book, which I was rather surprised about. So, you know, I think the struggle continues on that front. Even in a place like South Africa, where the literature is growing and it's quite rich, you still have to go a long ways to convince publishers to publish this kind of work. I'm not sure that so much has been written. There should have been more, frankly. And we still don't have access to the archives of the local organizing committee. So that's a problem. And the government of South Africa never released a final report. All we really have is a fairly substantial report from the Human Sciences Research Council about people's attitudes towards the World Cup, which is quite helpful and I think supports the analysis of most of the people in this book, and that is that there were great emotional returns, but there were no economic returns for the host nation. So, you know, if we had all those resources, I think we could start doing even more, and we need support from the publishers as well.
Christoph, did you have a...
Yeah, that was my... Sorry.
Go ahead.
That was my main point in reviewing the book, that throughout the book it becomes clear that ordinary South African football fans were excluded either by ticket prices or selling goods outside the stadium. And what you just said, Peter, underlines the fact that football research, football scholarship isn't maybe that widely acknowledged in South Africa as maybe in the US or in the UK.
Yeah, and I think it's true in other African countries. I mean, I have a graduate student currently in Lusaka doing the first academic history of football in colonial and post-colonial Zambia. I mean, to me, it's shocking that we are in the second decade of the 21st century and we still don't have a proper academic history of football in one of the leading footballing nations in Africa, where the former president, Kenneth Kaunda, was a huge football fan and invested ideological capital and economic capital in football to an unprecedented level. We still know nothing about this. And it's true in most other countries, even in Cameroon, which has gotten quite a bit of attention from people like Achille and André Ntomfo and Béa Vidash, Arnold Pannenberg. We've only scratched the surface. We have only scratched the surface. And yet, you know, in African studies particularly, we tend to rehash the same old topics. And it's true in Africa as it is outside of Africa. So, you know, this is the beginning of what I hope is going to be a much longer conversation and that will generate some change within academia. And it shows also how maybe by engaging with different kinds of audiences, some of this change can be perhaps moved along a little more swiftly.
Great. Just a note here, we're approaching the 45-minute mark, and we generally run 90 minutes in these sessions, so we're not quite yet halfway through giving everyone a chance to speak, so just everyone can bear that in mind with their questions and the responses as well. We can make sure that everyone gets a chance to give their comments or questions. Moving along, David Patrick Ling, who's author of a chapter on the Uruguayan team in this book, chronicling the Uruguayan World Cup experience across South Africa. One of my favorite chapters in the book, because I have many Uruguayan friends. Any questions or comments from you, David?
Yeah. Hi, Alex. Hi, everybody. Just a couple of questions, one on Uruguay, one on Africa. Can everybody hear me?
Yep.
Great. When I was in South Africa and in the book, I had attempted to show to the locals and ultimately to the readers that Uruguay had a serious African connection culturally, historically. The Suarez handball seems to have demonized Uruguay, and I was curious what the authors and what people here think about Uruguay now. Is it the dirty, cheating, sort of, for use of a, well, racist entity that robbed an African team of a place in the semi-final? Because that seems to be the sort of prevailing consensus in the narrative that you just pick up just in the ether. And the second question on the tournament and FIFA itself, we were talking earlier about Russia and Qatar and Brazil, but looking ahead to Africa as the next African country in the rotation, if there is still a rotation, I know Uruguay and Argentina have 2030 locked up. That would mean 2026. Is there the beginnings of a fight for that between African countries? Would that be broken down between North African entities, say Morocco, West African Nigeria, Cameroon, East African Kenya, perhaps, or even a Southern Africa if you look down at Angola? And would FIFA and the general footballing publics, do you think, the sort of Western publics be all that keen on a World Cup in one of those African countries? And I will take my answer off the air, as they say. Anyone have want to pipe in on that?
The image of Uruguay, Suarez as villain. Boy, that's a rich topic. Loran, you wrote about Suarez. You saw the handball at Soccer City. You were there. So were you, Achille, I think.
The Suarez as villain narrative has only become richer and richer since the World Cup.
Yeah, were you there? No, Achille was not there. Achille was staying home cooking for us.
I was not.
We got home. We were so depressed. We needed to eat a lot of pasta to get through the night. I write about it in the book and wrote about it in the Sports Illustrated piece recently. But yeah, it's interesting how I think, you know, that is probably the moment most people remember from the World Cup, more even than the final, certainly seared in a lot of imaginations. And I'm not sure that, yeah, anyway, it's I think it's great. And I do think that, you know, part of what the book does is to bring out all of these the ways that these moments were experienced on a mass and on a personal scale. So.
Any thoughts, Peter or Chris, about the next World Cup in Africa question?
The concern that I've always had with the way the South African World Cup was portrayed was this idea of an African World Cup. And as much as that it's an African World Cup in the sense it was held on the African continent, I mean, we have to look at the stats, and we talk about that in the introduction, the number of Africans from outside of South Africa who came to actually watch the games was very, very, very few. It's the first World Cup which has been billed as a continental World Cup. We don't hear Brazil being referred to as the South American World Cup, or Russia as the European World Cup, or as it tells, the Middle Eastern World Cup. And this is a concern I've always had, is that it's a, my sense is Africa's had its turn, and I wonder whether in my lifetime at least we'll get to see the World Cup on the African continent. If we do, I'd imagine it will probably be in North Africa, although, you know, we don't know.
Fantastic. How about David Roberts? David Roberts and Orly Bass were the authors of a co-authors chapter in the book, The World Cup Geography of Durban, What Will Endure. Do you all have questions or comments, the others?
I can start. I think one of the things that I've been fascinated with, both in my kind of research in South Africa, but also this conversation, is this idea that a lot of mega event research is always looking to the next event, right? And so we don't focus enough attention or enough energy on what are the legacies. And there was, you know, some discussion about legacy planning for the South African World Cup along the lines of the Centers for Hope and others, and other kind of, I would say, superficial interventions as a consequence or as a benefit of hosting the World Cup. But I think both as kind of fans of the game and as scholars of the game, this idea of what are these legacies and how can we be better at planning for them and also monitoring whether or not there are actual legacies gets lost often in terms of mega events. I would like to hear other people's comments on that. Great.
Hi.
I mean, yeah, go early. Yeah.
To write with David on this chapter in this book on our experience in Durban, I think David started to touch on that fact, and we mentioned it in the chapter, kind of the dual role of ourselves as experiencing the World Cup as fans, as it were, but also in terms of, bringing kind of our academic concerns into what was happening around public spaces in Durban in particular.
Would anyone like to pick up on any of these questions or comments? Peter?
We lost part of Orly's comment towards the end when she was talking about the being a fan and an analyst at the same time, and then we lost her.
I was just saying that, part of the interesting thing about working on this chapter was trying to combine that analytical perspective with a kind of attention to the fact that we were also experiencing the World Cup in our personal capacities as, enjoying the World Cup as fans. And I think that was an interesting tension and an interesting way to work through the issues that we did in the chapter.
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. And we kind of saw this play out in a similar way in Brazil during the Confederations Cup, where the same people, in some cases, who were protesting outside of the stadiums against FIFA, against the Brazilian organization of the World Cup and the misdirection of funds, were then celebrating Brazil's victories and cheering the nation on the football pitch. and that people didn't seem to feel this was contradictory or schizophrenic or hypocritical in any way. It was part and parcel of the same experience. It's rather remarkable, actually.
Alex, can I come in?
Absolutely, go ahead.
This is one of the striking features. The question I've always asked myself since the uprising, if you like, or the demonstrations in Brazil, why did we not have the same in South Africa? And my sense is that in the build-up to the World Cup, President Zuma was very keen to push the line that we're in the eyes of the world. We want to be projected as this world-class nation, and that we can pull off this mega event, and we were unpatriotic if we went out on the streets and demonstrated. So there's a tension there for me. On the one hand, where South Africans living in absolute squalor, but in the same time enjoying the football and having significant resources spent on these what have now subsequently become white elephants. So Zuma pushing this line of patriotism, I think, is central.
Fantastic. Moving, does anyone have any other concluding thoughts on this line? Or we can move on to Derek Katzen. Go ahead, Derek.
Oh, I just typed in my comment, which was that my understanding was that FIFA sort of brought about the rotation system in order to give South Africa the World Cup and immediately pulled that rug out from under. I don't believe they're doing the rotation anymore, are they? Didn't they themselves say that they sort of changed their mind?
That's correct. I think they did away with that rule way back in 2007 or thereabouts. Once it served its purpose of delivering 2010 to South Africa, the executive committee did away with that, partly out of dissatisfaction, I hear, of how Brazil went about organizing it, given that they had no competitors and sort of sat on their laurels for quite a few years. And we're seeing some delays in the preparations as an example of that.
Dave, did you want to give Dave a chance to ask a question?
Are we still online?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Great.
Can I just ask something?
The book is called Africa's World
Cup. Sure, go ahead and
yeah. Yeah, just to follow up on that,
go ahead.
You said.
We can't hear you here in East Lansing.
Okay. Yeah, this is David, Peter. Yes. Would it not be incumbent upon African football federations to not actually push, even though there is no so-called rotation anymore, but to actually push for it regardless? Or are they just going to be complicit in that deal as well? Or do they not need to have a World Cup?
I'm not sure. I would like to see a kind of African World Cup like the Euro 2020 that is being put on the table, a truly transnational one. Mm-hmm. I think, mm-hmm. On the African continent, you know, by using air links, one could use, say, many of the main capital cities as the host cities for a truly Pan-African World Cup.
Right.
And
right.
That might be a better route than heaving all of these costs and these
right.
burdens on a single nation or perhaps even two neighboring ones.
Mm-hmm. That seems a fantastic idea. I know the World Club Cup is due for Morocco next, so that's... just an interesting side note, but that's a fantastic idea because just for me personally, from my first experience of South Africa in South Africa and subsequently in Mozambique, it was, my appetite was, you know, was I was up for the next World Cup wherever it would be on the African continent. And to think that, oh, well, it's only going to be in South Africa because that's the way they've structured it, it was disappointing. But the Pan-African idea, I think, is fantastic if people can get behind that.
Peter, how about Dave's question there in East Lansing?
Yeah, Dave.
So the book is called Africa's World Cup, and a few of the pieces touched on how South Africans felt towards other teams after South Africa's elimination. But I was wondering how, if you had any idea how Africans from other nations that weren't involved in the World Cup, if they felt any differently about this World Cup as compared to previous ones.
Chris?
Yeah, I'm here. Just at the opening game, Mexico against South Africa, I was at the game, and as I was going through the turnstiles, there was a chap who had a billboard on his, carrying a billboard. He said, Africa proved the world wrong. And I started chatting to this chap, and he was from Cameroon. And his sense was that definitely this was an African World Cup, and he was obviously supporting South Africa against against Mexico, which ended 1-1. And that's one anecdotal experience I had. But as I've already said, there were so few Africans from outside of South Africa in South Africa during the World Cup. It's difficult to know.
What about folks who are in on this conversation who are in South Africa right now? Do you have any reflections on this, given sort of underlying xenophobic tensions within the country that, you know, were obviously at the surface before the 2010 World Cup and have also returned since then? And also in light of President Zuma's comments just recently, about you know, say, telling South Africans not to act like Africans. No.
if we don't have any bites on this, we can move on to another question. Okay, I'll take that as a sign to move on to another line.
I'm sorry, we had a little technical glitch, but Ashil was going to respond to that.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Just took a second to unmute.
Now, I was saying that those comments were the most unfortunate, and they have, first of all, they really reveal a lot about what part of the South African elite really thinks about the continent. And on the other hand, they have been condemned by a lot of South Africans. And South Africa is organizing, I think, in January or February, the next African Cup of Nations. So I guess the relationship between South Africa and the rest of the continent will be, in the coming years, characterized by a lot of ambivalence. And one will just have to work with that.
Mm-hmm. Rowani, do you have any input? Rowani, we might have found him away from his keyboard, or maybe muted. Okay, how about Raj? How about Jacqueline? Is Jacqueline on the call?
If anyone wants to intervene, just use the chat function in Skype, and that's a good way to alert Alex, who's moderating thousands of miles away in Buenos Aires, as to what possible avenues of conversation are on the horizon.
How about anyone else in East Lansing there?
What about, yeah.
Or Derek? Derek also has another thought.
Well, you know, I wonder, in terms of this idea of sort of Africans embracing Africa's World Cup or South Africans embracing the other teams, I can't help but think about when Ghana was about to play Uruguay, and the Sowetan had that great cartoon that had won the map of Africa that was all blacked out except for Ghana in Ghana's flag. And then next to it, they had the panel of the entire continent as Ghana's flag. And I thought that was a really interesting way that, I mean, it was obviously quite temporal and short term and didn't speak to maybe any larger dynamics. But I remember at the time, certainly South Africans were fully behind African teams, and especially Ghana when they advanced.
Alex, responding to Derek's point, I mean, I remember that I was in the stadium, Ghana against Uruguay, and a number of white South Africans, I would say at least a dozen that I saw, who were wearing wigs and had painted their faces black. And this was highly problematic for me. And chatting to these fellow South Africans, asking what they were doing, and their immediate responses were supporting Ghana. And I cynically responded to them, said, "Well, have you ever been to a Bafana game?" And of course, the response was no. So, I'm a bit cautious for this this Bagana notion, in the sense that, again, going back to exclusion, the number of South Africans who couldn't go to the stadiums, and those who did go to the stadiums just joined the party because it was a party, not because it was something broader around Ghana and a real Pan-Africanism. So excuse me for sounding slightly cynical there, negative, but my sense that it was something different.
This is David just piping in. I agree with the caution on that. My experience of being in South Africa was not that, even up until, well, perhaps with the exception of the day before the Ghana-Uruguay match, most South Africans were enamored with the big stars of other African teams, Drogba, Ivory Coast, so on, but also the big stars of European teams and the various paraphernalia hanging from windows of people's abodes and the shirts people were wearing and so on suggested equal support for what many people thought were the sexier team, the glamorous team, or the team most likely to win. And it really wasn't about Africa as much as I had hoped or expected it to be. And I think things mushroomed on the day of the Ghana-Uruguay match, as obviously you would expect it to. But I don't think it was organic in any way. I found it quite contrived. And then I found it kind of awkward for people to get sort of that bad taste in the mouth when what happened was is what happens in football games since I can remember watching football game. You know, somebody handballs the ball to stop it going in and a penalty is taken and they get sent off. And not long ago before, they weren't even sent off. They were just booked or what have you. Anyway, that's what I found. I didn't find this. I agree with Chris. I didn't think people were in love with Ghana up until, you know, she was the only game in town, you know?
Raj, did you want to ask your question out loud, or shall I read it from the chat?
Hi, this is Raj. Yeah, you can read it, or I can read it.
Go ahead.
Are we really saying that what Suarez did was wrong? Is that what we're, you know, this group or people we've come in contact with, is that what we're saying, that what Suarez did was wrong? Or is it connected to racism?
In the chapter, this is Peter, in the chapter, Davy clearly lays out his position on this, which is that he wasn't wrong. He did what any good footballer would have done. If he doesn't save that ball with his hand, the ball goes in, the game ends, and Ghana goes to the semifinals, Uruguay is eliminated. Am I wrong, Davy?
You're very correct, Peter. You know, the interesting thing about this, and because when you're traveling and watching the games live, you miss a lot of the videos of the games. And even before, I only watched the game in its entirety after actually I had penned the chapter. And what I noticed for the first time was that in the melee that had taken place, with Suarez was on the line, I think with Jorge Fuchile, he'd actually stopped the ball from going in maybe about 3 or 4 seconds earlier with some part of his knee or something. So he'd already stopped the ball going in. He was just doing what any other player would do. And that's football, as far as I can make out.
So what you is what you're saying is that you think Suarez didn't do anything wrong, but a lot of people, because they were frustrated that Ghana couldn't make it to the next stage, started connecting him and Uruguay with racism, where in fact it was not connected with racism.
They did connect it with, well, I don't have to use the word racism, but they connected it with something that, how would you put this, that they punished Uruguay without really knowing about Uruguay, its history, and so on. So, and in a way, they made Uruguay out to be a quote unquote, for use of a better term, a white nation. You know, a nation. You know, that does. You know, this is the kind of crime that this sort of a nation of. You know, and then it became something else. You know, it became a whole different type of racism. You know, it became the type of thing that people talked about before the tournament. You know, the reputation of Uruguay being these slick, sort of oily, sort of, you know, greasy types who commit fouls, who spit, and this, that. So the whole narrative was already in play. You know, and that came back. Once the handball had taken place,
perhaps this sort of Pan-African hostility towards Uruguay after the result of Ghana being knocked out is further evidence of what Andrew talks about in his chapter, this us versus them, immediate lines being drawn that are often contradictory if we look at Uruguay's history with black footballers and the vital role Uruguay has played in providing a venue for black footballers in the earliest of international competition. Maybe this is a point of in data in favor of what Andrew's talking about, that there is always going to be these line draws that are us and them, and that there are always going to be contradictions behind them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that.
Am I doing injustice to your argument, Andrew?
Oh yeah, you're doing justice. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, my primary perspective is as a psychologist, and it is amazing to me consistently how easily people slip into and out of group identities, and I think sports fandom generally is a fascinating venue for that, and I think that's going on all the time. I, you know, myself, I hadn't thought of it in relation to the Suarez stuff, but it does seem plausible, and it also seems especially plausible in relation to South African fans kind of latching on to Ghana, and I do think the cues from the way that FIFA framed the World Cup, which was as an African World Cup, which was, of course, a unfortunate oversimplification of what it means, you know, to have a continent host a World Cup, which of course it wasn't the whole continent hosting it, but that, I think those kinds of cues are classic ways of shaping social identity, and it, you know, it, in that regard, it's not surprising that people would latch on to that, particularly after all the other African teams were out. But whether that's deep or abiding, it's often not. It's really, what's amazing psychologically is that it's really powerful at the moment. I mean, people can be deeply immersed in it and take, you know, make behaviors that are irrational and deeply committed, but ultimately sort of meaningless. But, you know, the argument in psychology is that that's really sort of a predisposition of the mind. It's something that was probably adaptive at some point in human history, and it's activated now by strange things that weren't there in the hunter-gatherer environment, like national soccer teams that are, we all know, rationally artificial representatives of a nation, but they're very visible and they're very visceral, so they trigger something in our minds.
But I think at the same time, it's difficult to generalize on this idea that, you know, dislike or worse, maybe even hatred of Uruguay was widespread among Africans. I mean, in the same chapter that Davy wrote, he quotes a Nigerian academic, you know, saying what I also heard from many other folks at the World Cup. And this is what he says. He says, this is a quote from the Nigerian academic, "Suarez is a player after my own heart. He gave it all. Some say his action was reflex, but I don't think so. He took a calculated risk. He either stopped the ball with his hands or the ball stopped Uruguay's progress. He got the red card. Ghana got the penalty. Ghana missed the penalty. Today, Suarez is the hero of his nation. Where's the injustice? The injustice maybe is that John missed the penalty. But, you know, there was a punishment. There was a consequence. You could argue that had Suarez not done that also, you know, he would have played in the semifinal against the Netherlands, and maybe the outcome might have been different there. So not all fans agreed with this kind of, you know, Suarez is the reason why Ghana was eliminated, or that this has, you know, reflects poorly on Uruguay as a whole. I think a lot of people also recognize the act for what it was, a desire not to lose.
Well, further to that, Peter,
difficult to generalize about how so many different people.
Well, and another thing just further to that is that how actually a lot of people got more angry after the event. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
How they viewed his celebration of the subsequent miss. But what I found interesting as well is how Suarez, in the melee after it, as people were pointing fingers, Suarez did a classic sort of cheeky sort of walk in a different direction and did the classic what football players do, is act completely surprised when the referee picked him out through a crowd of Uruguayans and Ghanaians and said it was you, you know, and Suarez looked at him as if to say, like, who, me, what, you know? And to a lot of people, particularly I found as well, white South Africans watching all of this, this was a whole code of conduct that they just had never sort of come across before, you know? And that bothered them, you know, more so than the black South Africans. This is what I found interesting, was that white South Africans brought up on this sort of cricket and rugby, and of course cricket has changed and rugby has changed a lot now, but they had this sense that, you know, this is not how you do things, you know? But my point with Suarez and with football culture in different parts of the world is that it is different. And what Suarez was doing was how I looked at football in South America or in various parts of Europe. You know, this is how you do it. This is the game. And if you don't like it, you know, go play rugby or cricket, you know? So,
Alex?
Sure, Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, Debbie, I got to disagree with you there. I think you've got to look at people like Hansie Cronje in cricket and go look at the brutal game that the Springboks play. I don't think that's fair. Just
well, I, no, I was I made that point. I made the point that that's changed now in the modern world of 20 years or so. How it's looked in the textbook fashion is different. You know, the public school fashion is different.
Yeah,
I went
look.
School where people walking around having an old-fashioned view about what water polo, cricket, and rugby were, and football was not, you know, not their game at all. So, but I agree with you on that. Yeah, for sure.
I mean, the point I'd like to make very briefly about the Suarez incident is that Ghana had the opportunity in the last minute of extra time to put the penalty away. They didn't. They also had the opportunity in the penalty shootout. But going back to this idea of Africa's World Cup, I think we need to go back to the original bid books. And I've had access to both sets of bid books, the bid books from the 2006 World Cup. And we must remember that South Africa was bidding against Germany, England, Brazil at that stage. And it made sense for the South African organizers to pitch it as an African World Cup because that would have so much more clout than a South African World Cup in against a German or British or an English or a Brazilian World Cup. Of course, with the rotation principle of 2010, South Africa couldn't push this idea of an African World Cup. And if you look at the 2010 bid books, what they do is they basically guarantee FIFA will be making a significant profit. And they state as such. And I think that is the reason why South Africa got the World Cup and indeed why Russia and Qatar have got the World Cups after Brazil. It's the financial implications rather than anything else.
We have about 15 minutes left. If anyone has any new topics to introduce or questions about specific chapters or for the authors, or if anyone's been hiding a second question in reserve, or anyone that we haven't heard from yet.
Yeah, this is Raj. I just have a question for everybody on this call, or at least the protagonists of this call. That is the general view that a World Cup doesn't really bring that much to a country, to the host country, or improve the level, the quality of football played in that country? Is that the general view we have, or am I mistaken in that? I'll take my answer off the air.
I mean, I think the evidence is pretty clear, with only a very small number of exceptions in relation to the World Cup and the Olympic Games. Historically, they have not been profitable enterprises. I mean, the evidence is there. So anyone who's trying to sell the boondoggle of huge mountains of cash, you know, flowing to the pockets of millions and millions of people as a result of hosting these mega events is selling a lie. And again, I'm going based on the evidence here. I mean, from an economic standpoint, it's a losing proposition. Now, if you want to argue that it's politically a wise thing, and that, you know, socially and culturally there might be some benefits, that's a different story. I mean, in the South African case, I think the emotional returns were important. But, you know, how do you quantify emotions? They are by nature intangible. So, you know, that's why they become highly politicized. And that's why I think, you know, the theme of patriotism is so important here. These appeals to people's emotions and gut instincts were very important in shaping the overall experience of 2010, the same way that I think might have been true in previous tournaments and probably will be in future ones. So it depends what a particular host nation wants to get out of these mega events. And I think in Brazil, the conversation is very much happening right now. I mean, clearly the political class and probably a sizable chunk of the economic elite supports the hosting of the World Cup. But the citizens, I think there's quite a lot of legitimate criticism posed at the organizers. And it's both FIFA and the local organizing committee. So, you know, it depends what you want to gain from them. And I think transparency and accountability are a big part of the story that also don't play out in the hosting of the World Cup and often in the hosting of the Olympics, too. You know, just look at the FIFA report for 2010. I mean, they've posted it online. Go and look at the fine print. There's a lot of nebulous stuff out there, you know, and FIFA, again, is not known for transparency and accountability. So that's part of the problem, I think.
So I have a question that, if I can jump in.
Absolutely, Derek. Go ahead.
This is the question I've been debating back and forth when I write and think about the 2010 World Cup. So I'm curious to hear your responses. Given all that the 2010 World Cup did not do for South Africa, are you glad it was there? And I don't know how I answer that question, because selfishly, I had a marvelous time. I go to South Africa every year, and it was certainly one of the best trips that I've ever had. It seemed like, from a short-term vantage point, there was a great deal of joy on people's faces. But I know what happened after, you know, the fan parks closed down and after you walked away from the stadium. And I know these development questions that haven't really been answered satisfactorily. So what do you all think? Are you happy it was there or not?
Orly or Chris?
Look, as a football fan, I was thrilled it was there. And if you look at my chapter, hopefully that sentiment comes across. But as an academic and as a sociologist, the more distance I have from the World Cup, the more critical I become.
Yeah, I think in the round table, you know, both Thabo Tlatla and Mohlomi Maubane, you know, speak to this contradiction. You know, they both say it was great to have the tournament here, but, you know, it was a problematic experience. Personally, I mean, it was one of the most meaningful months in my time ever in South Africa. And I think many South Africans felt the same. So, you know, I think we need to be comfortable with this contradiction, that, that you can enjoy the moment while at the same time, like Orly was saying earlier, retain some analytical distance and not get too caught up in the moment and be able to, reflect on it critically.
This is Andrew Guest. Can I just chime in quickly? I'm pretty much an outsider here, but I was in South Africa briefly this last summer, summer in U.S. time anyway, in June, July. And one thing I had the chance to do was visit the quote-unquote Football for Hope Center in Khayelitsha, which got a lot of coverage during the tournament and is sort of fascinating to me because I have an interest in sports and development. And, the whole kind of marketing of FIFA around the development angle is obviously a very interesting one, and the legacy of that. And one of the most frustrating to me is that 20 centers for 2010 thing, which got tons of publicity, was all over the fan parks and everything. And those centers are still not completed. And it's just 20 centers. I mean, it's such a drop in the bucket for an organization like FIFA. And the Khayelitsha one was honestly, you know, not being utilized the way that it should. It was already falling into disrepair. And the bottom line is just, I when I think about like whether, you know, it was a good thing or a bad thing, and I think other folks have well laid out the arguments for sort of the potential emotional and political benefits versus the economic costs. But it does seem to me like a ongoing question in the sense that, you know, do people become more aware of how FIFA and other mega events kind of take advantage of the emotional benefits? And that's where the question of the protests in Brazil becomes really interesting to me, because Chris mentioned earlier, thinking about why didn't those kinds of protests that happened at the Confederations Cup happen in South Africa. And I wonder if part of it is that because they watched and learned a little bit from South Africa, that the South Africa tournament was the first tournament in recent times in the sort of global South. It was the first tournament in recent times in a place where it's become such a commercial mega event, where it really did have the potential to unduly take advantage of sort of emotional and political capital. And so that makes it so interesting for me to see what happens with Brazil in the actual World Cup. Like, do these protests continue? Do Brazilians kind of say to FIFA, like, no, you can't create an autocratic dictatorship for 4 weeks within our country? And if they do, then I think that actually might have something to do with with South Africa and how things have played out there. And I also think, again, to me, as somebody who tries to periodically write about this stuff or think about this stuff, like, there's a legacy for us too to kind of keep writing about South Africa, keep talking about it, and keep it on the radar that it was not just these 4 weeks, that there was legacies for good and for ill, and that, again, FIFA should be held accountable for getting huge marketing points for their development efforts when actually substantially nothing.
Jacqueline, you were talking about being at the African Cup of Nations in 2013. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Hello? Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. I know Chris just commented and says that the stadiums were empty. I guess from my perspective or from my view, it was just probably poor sales strategy for the ticket by the organizers. And then a couple of months later, I heard in a press conference that the organizers released, they said that they made a profit. And I think certainly that profit only came because they had very little expenditure towards the organization of the event, because they benefited from the 2010 World Cup. So my view is that, okay, although yes, definitely a lot of the infrastructure, I used the GAU train and I had to get a bus from the city center of Joburg to get to where the station was, and certainly it's great infrastructure, but I was told that the tickets use that bus and the train is very expensive. I think South Africa, or for example, the city of Gauteng, didn't really have an after the World Cup for what the infrastructure would be used for, like a thought through plan on how to integrate it into for how it could be used by the public. That's all I have to say.
Chris or Peter, do you want to?
Alex?
Sure. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, this was a comment in reference to the African Nations Cup of 2013, right?
Yeah. Ode, did you want to chime in as well?
Yes, please, if I may.
Yes, of course.
Sorry, I actually just wanted to go back to what Chris and Peter were saying about the World Cup in South Africa. And I kind of wanted to echo their sentiments about this kind of conflictual notion of whether, you know, it should have been held in South Africa or not. I think that, you know, I think it's, you know, there isn't, one answer in any particular in any particular way or direction, but I think that it's really important to be kind of cognizant of the context, the histories of what happened, and try and look at the both the positives and of course the negatives that have resulted from that.
Peter, Chris, do you have any concluding thoughts as the editors on any of these last questions that we've been discussing?
Well, I think the last comment is for me, and I think what it suggests, and this is something I try and argue in my own academic work, is that football in South Africa is just so much more than a game, to refer to the cliche, at so many different levels. I think we need so much more on football, on soccer in South Africa, and that's slowly coming about.
Peter, how about a final word?
I just want to thank everyone for reading the book and engaging with its ideas. And I think it's difficult to discuss an edited book, even in my classes. I tend not to assign edited books because it's hard to do them justice because of the diversity of approaches and sources and perspectives. But I think the conversation was really fruitful, and I got a lot out of it, and I hope you did too. And, one last thing is that the way it was written, it was also meant to appeal to people who want to read this in any kind of order, sort of randomly. The chapters are sort of short for the most part. And so if you haven't had the chance to read it thoroughly, you can pick up the book and read one chapter one night, come back to it 2 months later, read another one, and hopefully it'll still make sense and it'll still be a worthwhile experience. And I also like what Laurent was saying at the beginning, that maybe this group, the Football Scholars Forum, should start seriously thinking about putting our minds together and working towards producing some kind of online guide, if you want to call it that, reflections on the upcoming 2014 World Cup in Brazil, and we can use our website, footballscholars.org, to do that. So let's figure out how to make it work.
Fantastic. Thanks, everyone, for your time.